Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to this week's Failed Critics Podcast. I'm Steve Norman and I'm joined by Owen Hughes.
Hello.
Liam.
Hello.
And Maya Brooker.
Hello there.
As we have a bit of a Stephen King themed podcast this week with the release of The Dark Tower, we are going to be taking a triple bill of our favourite Stephen King adaptations, as well as the usual bits and pieces and a review of The Dark Tower itself. We're going to start off with the quiz with me hosting. And Owen, what's the score at the moment?
It's still 0-0 because we haven't had a quiz since you lost. Since you lost ages ago and have somehow connived to not review Dangerous Game yet. I don't know how that has happened.
Well, we were going to have a football special with Paul Field. And that didn't happen. And that's when we were both going to watch it for that. And then we did our Sharknado thing. And it didn't really fit with that. And then last week, I just didn't
bother.
No. To be honest, I can't remember where the source was that I was watching it from.
Oh, dear.
But if you want to send it to me again, I'll happily watch it for next week's podcast. But yes, we do have a quiz. I've themed it around Stephen King himself, because it seemed appropriate, and I was lacking original ideas today. So it's Owen versus Maya and Liam, who are playing on my behalf, trying to score a point for me. And the first question, all multiple choice, the first question, when Stephen King first started writing, he used a pseudonym. What was it? Was it A, Richard Bachman, B, Richard Hackman, or C, Richard Buckman?
I know this one. So do you want me to go second?
You go second if you think you know it.
Isn't the first one his real name? So I don't know. Is it Richard Bachman? It's definitely one he used, but whether that's his real name, that he didn't he use that name for like the other type of novel at first, and then use Stephen King for horror.
I'm just going from his IMDb trivia page. I mean, I've not got a great deal of information from that. Yeah. Would you like to hazard a guess? Was it A, Bachman, B, Hackman, or C, Buckman?
I'd guess at A, but I don't know it.
We'll go for A then, because I have no idea.
Okay. And Owen, you say you know the answer?
Yeah, his pseudonym, his whatever they call it when they write stuff, pen name, was Bachman.
Yes, you're both correct. It was Richard Bachman. Answer A. The second question, which of these statements is true? He burns the books of anyone who sends him one asking for it to be signed and returns the ashes to the person. B, he won't sign autographs due to superstition. Or C, he won't sign autographs as he hates the idolising of celebrities.
Oh, interesting.
One of them is true. The other two were strongly rumoured but proved false.
I reckon it's C. I reckon he doesn't like the idolising of celebrity status.
Yeah, that's it. Didn't Ringo Starr do something very similar to this? Because he put out some video constantly repeating the words peace and love, I won't sign anything.
Yeah, he was sick of it, wasn't he?
He was sick to death of it, and I think that...
That sounds strange, because there's that Simpsons episode where Marge does the... He does his voice in it, I believe, and he's replying personally to every bit of correspondence he gets.
Yeah, I think that might have given people ideas or something.
I think it'd be B, but I'm not entirely sure.
I'm more than willing to go with that because I think C sounds a bit Ringo.
Yeah.
What happened with Ringo? So, yeah, I'll be able to go with B then, yeah.
And Owen, what did you want to go for?
I think it was C, the celebrity status one.
Okay, Owen, you are correct. It's C. He won't sign them as he hates idolising celebrities. The one I wanted to be true was burning the books and sending the ashes back to people. Yeah. Question three, with it being 2-1 to Owen. He wrote the novel Running Man in how many days? 10 days, 50 days, or 100 days?
There's only one of those that makes sense to me, which would be 10 days, because then it would be trivia.
It doesn't seem particularly over the top to do any of the other.
It's a short novella, isn't it? I reckon it's A. I reckon 10 days.
I think it as well, to be honest. I'd say. Yeah.
Yes, both teams were right. It is A, meaning it is now 3-2 to Owen. The fictional town for question four, where many of his stories take place or feature. Now, I went a bit, like this morning quiz show or quiz question on the answers for this. Is it A, Casterly Rock, B, Castle Rock, or C, Fraggle Rock?
I know this one.
Oh, I don't.
If you text in the wrong answer, you will be charged.
I don't know this one, so I'll guess first and say Casterly Rock. It sounds like something I've heard before, but I don't know why.
I'm pretty sure it's B. I'm reading one of his novels right now, and I'm pretty sure it's B, Castle Rock.
Yeah. It sounded familiar to me, actually, Castle Rock.
Yes, you are correct, Maya and Liam, is Castle Rock, poising it with 3-3.
What's Casterly Rock then? Is that from something?
Heard of Casterly Rock. It is from something. Now, Fraggle Rock is from Fraggle Rock. Casterly Rock, Owen, if you're a fan of the TV show Game of Thrones, is where you would have heard Casterly Rock for. It is the seat of House Lannister.
Yes.
Right. That's why. Confusing with kings.
Yes. Different. And dragons and stuff. Question five. Which Nightmare on Elm Street did he get offered to direct? Was it Nightmare on Elm Street 3, 4, or 5?
Probably.
To be honest, they fell right off the cliff, didn't they?
Dream Warriors is all right.
I think it might be 3. But I'm not sure, to be honest.
Yeah. I'm more than happy to go with that.
That's a proper guess.
I think 3 was the one that kind of revived the series a little bit, because that was Dream Warrior. So I reckon probably after that they went, well, Stephen King is a good name. So, yeah, I'll go 4.
It was actually number 5.
Oh. Yeah.
So it's still a tie, 3 apiece, but I've got a tie break.
Oh, good.
And this is, according to Box Office Mojo, what is the highest grossing Stephen King adaptation movie? Not what it is, it's The Green Mile, but what did it gross? What is its total gross?
Does shitloads count
I don't know. I mean, if Owen goes for 2 shitloads or half a shitload, I don't quite know.
Yeah.
But the answer is in US dollars.
I don't even know the ballpark.
I can't think what else would have been like. It's not The Dark Tower that's his second highest grossing film, because that has grossed fuck all in the cinemas. So
no, the second highest grossing one is one I must admit I've not heard of. 1408.
Oh, I've watched that. I like that one.
From 2007. Yeah.
No, can't say I've even heard of that.
I watched it. It's not very good.
I mean, while you're thinking, to run through the top 10 to kill a bit of time, 3 was Misery, or is Misery, 4 is Pet Sematary, 5 Stand By Me, 6 Secret Window, 7 The Shining, 8 The Dark Tower, 9 The Running Man, and 10 is 2013's version of Carrie.
Well, isn't Shawshank Redemption in there anywhere?
Shawshank Redemption is 15th.
Yes.
Mm.
Blimey.
That's terrible.
Although it wasn't very big at the cinema, was it? So
No,
Lawnmower Man is 13th. It's higher than the Shawshank Redemption. But yes, let's go then. Who's Owen? You go first.
Oh, I don't know. $80 million.
Okay. And Maya and Liam, what would you like to guess?
Do you want to do
one of those sneaky ones where you go eight? You know, you add one. You want go £1 over or £1 under just to screw him?
Or a bit mean spirited.
Yeah, I would have gone higher than that.
I
think so. Yeah, yeah. So what? So I don't know, 92.5.
Yeah, that's fine. It's exactly what I was thinking.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
Maya and Liam have won the question and won the quiz. The correct answer would have been 136,801,374. So, yes, they have won. Owen has lost. It's almost twice as much as the second one, 1408.
Yeah.
If that is of any interest. So, yeah, the Green Mile.
Is Carrie on that list anyway?
Carrie, the original, is 11th, about $1.5 million behind the 2013 version.
Wow.
I mean, obviously, Box Office Mojo, these ones aren't adjusted for inflation or anything like that. But, yeah. Anyway, that is the quiz. I have got a point. Owen has not. On to next week. Let's see what happens. The news, though, there was one bit of news that Owen wanted to bring up, which was a remake or another adaptation of Nosferatu.
Nosferatu. That's
him.
The original was a silent film by F.W. Murnau, which was 1922, which is still great. I mean, still just really good and atmospheric and creepy and stuff. I guess most people will know Nosferatu because of that version, which has the sort of lanky, bald, buck-tooth kind of vampire that creeps around through it. Not too dissimilar to Salem's Lot, actually, the Stephen King book, but was obviously a rip-off of Bram Stoker's Dracula. But anyway, regardless of that, it was remade in the 70s by Werner Herzog, which is one of the reasons I wanted to bring this up, because I know, Liam, when we've talked about horror films in the past on the website and on the podcast with you, Nosferatu has always sort of creeped up as one of your favourites, the remake, that is, with Klaus Kinski.
That's right, the Werner Herzog version with Klaus Kinski, And the bloke whose name plays Hitler in Downfall.
Yeah.
I can never remember his name.
Me neither, off the top of my head.
It's weird. For some reason, they made it twice, once in English, once in German, rather than dub it or anything. And I think the only thing I can think of is the guy who, Hitler from Downfall, fella. I only think he wasn't very good at English and had learned it sort of parrot fashion.
Phonetically,
because
didn't he?
The English version just really doesn't seem to work. The German version just holds together much better, and yet it's exactly the same film shot at the same time, sort of thing, you know? And it just feels a hell of a lot better, looks and sounds better somehow to me, it just works a hell of a lot better. It's a fantastic film, extremely chilling and cold one. Brilliant film, really keen on that one.
Yeah, it is really good, but it's being remade by Robert Eggers, and it will star Anya Taylor-Joy. If they sound familiar, it's because Robert Eggers is the director of The Witch, which came out technically 2015, but didn't come out over here until 2016, which was a really interesting, weird, kind of unsettling horror film about a family who are visited by a witch in the woods, and it's set in a sort of colonial American times. Really interesting horror, which Maya, you've seen as well, I think.
I would definitely think unsettling is definitely the word for it. I watched it and it was just, you know, after I finished, I kept thinking about different scenes and it was quite unsettling, but really good at the same time. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was one of those films as well that was funny because, well, it wasn't funny. It wasn't a comedy, but it was interesting. I guess is more the word, because it was based on lots of documented accounts of people from that time who were accused of witchcraft, about the accusations of witchcraft around in that sort of area. I mean, again, just thinking of Salem and stuff like that.
Yeah, it was really interesting for that reason.
A bit like there's a Danish film, a Danish silent documentary drama thing called Haxan, which is about witchcraft as well, which is, it is really good. It is really good. It's kind of like that, but completely as a dramatisation, which again is why I think you definitely should watch it, Liam. I definitely think it'll be right up your street. The fact that Robert Eggers and Anya Taylor-Joy are involved in the Nosferatu remake is what fills me with confidence and why I'm happy for them to give that another go. And I think they can do something different than just make another vampire horror. I think that they can do something that's not necessarily been done before or even for a long time. So that's why I wanted to bring it up. I think it's quite exciting news, and I wouldn't normally be all for horror remakes, but that one in particular stands out to me as something perhaps to get excited about.
Yeah, if it's got the same kind of feel as The Witch, then yeah, it would be something quite interesting to watch.
Sounds good to me.
Time now for what you've been watching, where we take a look at some of the films we've seen in the last week or so, and this part will include Owen Meyer's review of The Dark Tower. But I'm going to kick us off in this section with what I've seen, and the one I want to talk about is a Netflix original called What Happened to Monday. It stars Naomi Rapace, Willem Dafoe, Glenn Close, and it's set in the future, about 60 years into the future from now, and the population of human beings has gone crazy. So there's too many people about and people are starving. So what they and some other stuff that humans have done have caused crops to fail, and there's not enough food to go around. So what the society has done is decided to limit families to one child. And if you have more than one child, the eldest is put into, or what we believe to be, cryogenic sleep to be awakened again once all the problems have been solved and there's enough resources to go around. What then happens is a lady has septuplets, seven children, and dies and in childbirth. And her granddad, or the children's granddad, played by Willem Dafoe, rather than giving in to the authorities, he takes them all in, hides them, names them all after one day of a day of the week, and they're all allowed out on the one day. So Monday does Monday, Tuesday does Tuesday, and they grow up like that. At a point, they get found out when they're adults by the government, and then there's different plot threads going on without spoiling it. More and more is revealed as the sisters try and find out what happened. Basically, Monday goes missing, and the sisters have to try and find out what happened to her without revealing that there's seven of them. Mm-hmm. And there's also another thread about, you know, in the plot about what happens to the older siblings that get cryogenically frozen. There's kind of a plot surrounding that as well. I suppose in some ways with regards to Naomi Rapace playing seven characters, a bit like, has anyone seen Orphan Black?
No.
Or know of Orphan Black?
I know of it, but I haven't watched it yet.
Yeah. That's about cloning, but it's the same woman playing multiple versions of herself or multiple versions of the same clone. And I suppose this is because Naomi Rapace playing seven different people, but they're identical septuplets. Mm-hmm. It's a clever idea, and at the start I enjoyed it. Some of it, you know, what I thought they were going to overdo, and they didn't in the end, was kind of they flash back to when the Septuplets are children. And this is when Willem Dafoe's character, the granddad's in it. He's not in it when they're adults, the main body of the film. He's not in it. He's passed away or whatever. But he's in it when they're children. They're kind of going through the problems, why they can't reveal there's seven of them and how they have to do it. And there's one scene, really graphic and a bit grim, but one of the, whichever day of the week it's allowed out, she's skateboarding and she hurts herself and she lops the tip of her finger off. So then because they've all got to appear identical, granddad's got to lop off the top of all their fingers. And it's just really graphic. Bloody hell. But no, I think Noomi Pace is good. She's obviously playing a lot of characters in it. So she's got a lot to do. Glenn Close is the antagonist, and she's reasonably good there. The ending, the more towards the ending you get, the more kind of Hunger Games it gets, if you know what I mean. Like, you know, the more like it ends up towards the end, it starts getting more like a Hunger Games film or a Divergent series film, one of those. But for the main body of the film, it's good but not great. It's an interesting idea that's pulled off for the most part well enough. It's definitely worth a watch, I'd say, and definitely one of the better. I know Netflix have done well with their like more episodic TV show kind of things, but not their movies. But this is probably one of the better movies I'd say they've put out.
It sounds interesting. It sounds like an interesting idea. Do you think it is a result of the Netflix algorithms again going, Orphan Black's quite popular, should we make something a bit like Orphan Black?
No, because it's not really like Orphan Black. It's the only way it's really like Orphan Black is the one person playing multiple versions of a character or a person.
Right.
So in Orphan Black, I watched the first two or three series of Orphan Black and quite liked it, but it just started getting more and more confusing and I kind of lost interest. But the main actress was playing multiple versions of a clone. There was different, you know, this woman had been cloned for some reason. I can't remember why now. And she was playing different versions of this clone. In what happened to Monday, she's playing different sisters. So they've all, but it's the same thing. They've all got distinct personalities and I suppose qualities and skills and whatever. So that's the only similarity, really. The plot's different, and you know, but I'd say it's definitely worth a watch, especially if you like kind of near future dystopian stuff like that.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, definitely worth a go. Liam, what have you seen this week?
I've seen an absolute belter. My film of the best film of the year for me so far, Lady Macbeth. And it's nothing to do with Shakespeare. It's purely it's based on. I got really into Russian literature when I was in my late teens, early 20s, sort of thing. And trying not to put anyone off this, it is not highbrow, not overly highbrow. It's based on a Leskov novel of similar name, and it's basically like a Madame Bovary type Lady Chatterley thing. So. Woman who is married off to the local landlord, sort of like estate owner. This has been transplanted to Northern England. Sort of, you're not told anywhere, but you would say from the accents and the scenery, sort of northeastish, Northumberland, Durham way.
Okay.
And yeah, she's married off to the local landlord. He treats her abominably. It's his sort of early mid 19th century, you'd say, and it goes in with the best of intentions, but it all gets shut down on her. She kind of starts and she's first a bit stalked and kind of half attacked by this new worker on the estate, but then she very quickly reciprocates and pretty much jumps on him, and it goes on from there. Spiral starts and breaks down into a complete, it's one of the most cold and chilling murder type films. It's you'd have to call it, I suppose it would get called a period drama type thing, but There's an awful lot of sex and violence involved as well, which usually does help these things, I think. But she certainly takes the lead and comes rushing out of her shell, and it is jaw-droppingly good. I can't say I've particularly heard of anybody in it. It's reasonably faithful to the novel, if anybody's read that. The ending is completely different, and this really benefits for it. It's been adapted by Alice Birch, who is not someone I'm not aware of her work, but keep your eye open because this is really good. It's a relatively unknown cast, apparently. Florence Pugh, who everyone's tipping as being the next big thing, type thing, she takes the lead and she's excellent. She really is a superb actress. Goes along, Cosmo Jarvis, who I've never heard of at all, is the male lead, Sebastian, he's the worker, the estate worker who she starts up an affair with, and she starts the murder off, but he is involved as well in the mayhem that ensues. I would say if it's got one fault, it might be her accent, which is sort of Durham via Durban and Dublin. It's a bit of a right mix-up. Her accent isn't the greatest at times. And where is this? Sorry? Once or twice does actually sound Irish. But other than that, it looks brilliant. The sound really works somehow. The inside of the house is appropriately echoey, and it leaves you in no doubt as to what a cold and horrible place this is to be. Cold in all senses of the word, not just temperature-wise. I have to say that Naomi Aki, who plays the servant, who's unfortunate enough to witness some of it and then becomes, her life just deteriorates beyond belief. This is on Curzon. Why I'm stumbling so much is I'm desperate not to give any spoilers away, because this is on Curzon at the moment, been recently added. Curzon and Mubi are probably my two go-to sources for film.
Mm-hmm.
This is on Curzon for £4.50. It's worth a five of anybody's money anytime. It's an hour and a half long. I'll tell you what, just watch it. It's fantastic. It's certainly, it's got a hell of a lot more to it than what you would call your average sort of period drama type thing. Definite recommend for me. Best thing I've seen this year.
Just on the mention of Curzon, I was going to ask, have you been to any Curzon cinemas at all?
I haven't, no.
There's one opening in Oxford in October, which looks very swanky. And they're likely to show films that I'm not going to see anywhere else, I think, at Curzon cinema.
That's right, yeah, they do tend to pick this. Yeah, that's why I love the app so much. App and website, sort of thing.
Yeah.
You've got a real mix of stuff on it, and they keep so much on there they've just got, you can search by country, by director, by genre, all sorts of brilliant stuff on there. But this is really highly recommended. I couldn't believe it was £4.50, to be honest. I thought it was going to be one of their tenor jobs. But even so, it's worth a tenner anyway. I'd still be singing its praises at a tenner.
Cool.
Superb film.
That was Lady Macbeth. Maya, what have you seen that wasn't The Dark Tower?
I went to see The Hitman's Bodyguard. Even though a lot of people told me not to go and see it, I wanted to have a little look at it. It's the Ryan Reynolds, Samuel Jackson, Gary Oldman's in it. I think her name's Elodie Young. Some people might know her as Elektra in Daredevil.
Oh, right.
The TV, Netflix series. Took me until the end of the movie to actually pinpoint where I knew her from, which says a lot about the movie if I was thinking more about that than, Ryan Reynolds and Samuel Jackson. It was okay. There were some funny bits in there. I went to see it with my brother, which was a really bad mistake because he likes repeating lines once they've been said.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
And all the funny ones, which then were not very funny. The crowd at the cinema seemed to really like it. They're all laughing along, and I think I liked most of it. And there were some, you know, bits of humour that were quite funny and really just made me chuckle for a little bit longer. But overall, it was okay. You know, Samuel Jackson plays a hitman that's got a lot of people after him, and Ryan Reynolds is his bodyguard, basically. And yeah, there's not much else to say. They all do what they're supposed to do. Samuel Jackson is Samuel Jackson. Uses the phrase motherfucker way too often. But then they do make a joke about that as well. Mm. Ryan Reynolds is brilliant with his sarky humour. And Gary Oldman was pretty good, actually. I quite liked him in that, with a quite interesting Russian accent, which he does quite well, in my opinion, anyway. It was a bit of fun. It was, if you don't want to be thinking about a movie, if you don't really want to be thinking about how it should be, like, you know, the storyline and the characters and how it actually all works together, if you just want a bit of popcorn fun, The Hitman's Bodyguard was that for me. I know a lot of people really, really disliked it. I just thought it was all right. An action comedy, and that's exactly what it was.
It's so interesting. The way you've described it is, to me, sounds like... Because it's directed by Patrick Hughes, isn't it? Who...
Yes, he directed
Expendables 3, and I would have described Expendables 3 as functional, in that it just does what it's supposed to do, and nothing particularly... outstanding about it. So that sounds similar to what Hitman's Bodyguard might be like.
I think that's exactly what it's like. I don't think I can say anything different other than, yeah, it's very much a typical Expendables, very formulaic. Mm. Just what you want, really. Just what you want in a fun popcorn movie. You know, go in an evening where you're just stressed and want something to laugh at, that will do it. Does it for most of the film for me, but not for a lot of them. But yeah, I think Ryan Reynolds for me had the most humour. And Salma Hayek actually was very funny. I love it when she swears, because her accent and language is just hilarious. And she was very, very cool in it. It's very much like Expendables 3 in that sense, in terms of it is just a bit of fun. And it does what it's supposed to do, which is get a whole cinema crowd laughing and giggling throughout it. It's not overly long. I think, let's have a look. It was... it's just under 2 hours.
Half an hour longer than The Dark Tower, though.
There were moments where I thought, come on, keep it going. And the ending was a bit... rubbish at times, but overall I quite liked it. Bit of an average film.
You always know if you're going well when someone comments on how long the film is. it was under two. You know, I'm trying to think of something, but it was under 2 hours, so that was good. That was The Hitman's Bodyguard. Now Owen and Maya have both seen The Dark Tower, the latest Stephen King adaptation to hit the cinema. Mm-hmm. Before you talk about the film itself, have either of you read the books, Dark Tower books?
No, I haven't.
I have all of them sitting on the shelf on my bookcase. I read the first one, didn't read any of the others, and it was so long ago that I read it, I remembered barely anything at all about it.
Why did you read one and not the others? Because you didn't like them?
It just felt like it was going to be a slog. I read that first one and, like, I'm not sure I'm fully committed now to reading the rest of these. I bought them as just a bundle. Okay. They're on sale. It might have been even when, like, Borders was closing down, I think. And I just went, right, I'm getting all these. And then read the first and was like... I mean, I get the... So, okay, well, I'll explain a little bit about Dark Tower first of all. It's obviously Stephen King's novel. Which is meant to be like his kind of magnum opus. You know, it's his whole series of fantasy books. There's 8 of them in total. Inspired by both The Lord of the Rings and The Good, the Bad and the Ugly. So if you can imagine a world that meshes those two together, that's what he was going for. And the first book, all I remember of it is, this is like Clint Eastwood fights magic. That's what it felt like.
Yeah.
And so the film, I think, tries to capture that vibe. But instead of Clint Eastwood, it's Idris Elba. I just think it was a bit wide of the mark. Which isn't meant to be a pun about the gunslinger who's always accurate and stuff. But I just think it was just plain, bland, vanilla, boring. I just didn't enjoy it very much. What did you think, Maya?
I thought it was less than all right. Really, really plain, quite boring. There were some bits in it that I thought were nice. Some of the acting I thought was okay. I quite often can't fault Matthew McConaughey or Idris Elba. But even they couldn't save it. It was just a bit boring and it was dry. I expected, it's a story about a gunslinger. I was expecting a bit more excitement from the film and it wasn't really there.
Yeah, it wasn't exciting, was it? Nothing. It just kind of, I think because one of the things that I read up about this over the weekend. So it's a 12A fantasy story, right? It's 12A rated and very much, I think, aimed at kids, but it is very heavy on the gun porn, right? There's lots and lots of, by which I mean they're into guns, not anything lewd, but with guns. No, I'm going off topic. So, like, what I mean is that it's very impressed with how people can be shot and killed by guns. And it kind of celebrates that, which makes it feel a little bit awkward. I mean, I like action movies, as I've said millions of times on here. We just mentioned Expendables. I'm a fan of the Expendables series. But this still kind of glorifies shooting people. And stuff like, I don't kill with my gun, I kill with my heart, or whatever he said as part of his mantra. It's like,
I saw it a few hours ago and I still can't remember what it was.
Yeah, I don't kill with my gun, I kill with my heart, and I don't something with my gun, I whatever it is.
With the mind, I don't know.
Yeah, with the mind.
Guns don't kill people, people kill people.
Yeah. Guns don't kill something people, like that. Rappers do.
Yeah.
Where was I going with that? Yeah, so basically, I think as far as like it being aimed at a 12A audience, I'm a little bit unsure if that's really what they should have done, because it comes out feeling like it's trying to be it wants to be a Percy Jackson or something of that ilk.
Yeah,
but it's just the source material is just a bit too mature for it to be that, I think. But then at the same time,
I was fully expecting it to be more violent, just by the fact that it is about a gunslinger and everything. Yeah, I'm like you. I thought it was a bit mature for a 12A.
Yeah. I mean, there's no, like, people aren't being, limbs aren't blown off with turrets attached to, tanks or anything like that. It's not that kind of, it is literally about him and his pistol, which is forged from the sword of Excalibur, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was interesting. That might be in a moment where I actually stopped and paid a bit more attention and thought, wait there, what did he just say?
Yeah, what are you even talking about, Matthew McConaughey? You weirdly creepy man. You strange, creepy man. In this, he is. I don't know him personally, but yeah, in this he's just a weird, he's the man in black. He's the villain. Who again I don't think is villainous. He's the bad guy because you're kind of told he's the bad guy and he makes a kid eating ice cream hate her mom for no reason.
Yeah.
You go, oh, what a bastard. What a git.
That was brilliant.
But that's about as far as it stretches to. You go, oh, what a git. Why is he destroying the tower again? Oh, it doesn't really matter. He just wants to destroy the tower. Oh, what an arsehole.
Yeah, it doesn't actually go into why he wants to do that at all, does it really? Unless I fell asleep.
No, no. If you did, I fell asleep at the same point because...
Okay, then.
It talks about he wants to use children's minds to power his weapon to blow up the tower that is holding the various universes together. Right.
But it doesn't explain why he wants to blow up the tower, does it?
Why? Yeah, it tells you what he wants to do. It tells you the consequences of him doing that. It tells you that Idris Elba is the last in the line of a group of gunslingers that tried to stop him from doing that. But there's no real motive apart from he wants to destroy the world. Okay. All right, then. Carry on with your story. Let's see where it goes. Oh, it goes nowhere. Nowhere does it go. It is just a series of scenes that have no real act to them. Could you tell people where the first act ends, where the second act begins, where the third act is in this? I mean...
Oh, God, no.
It doesn't feel structured like that. It's just lots of scenes cobbled on top of each other.
Yeah, there are a few cool bits with Matthew McConaughey, the way, you know, when he tells... people to, you know, stop breathing and other such things, and they were pretty cool. But it was quite confusing at parts, and I was quite often thinking, oh, I wonder how long I've got when I get home until I start recording the podcast. That's what I was quite thinking about.
It's directed by a guy called Nikolaj Arcel, who's Danish. His kind of main credits. He directed A Royal Affair with Mads Mikkelsen, which is actually quite good. I quite like that. But he also wrote the screenplay. I think he's primarily a screenwriter. He wrote the screenplay for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the original version.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Well, I think that it shows,
I liked it.
I think he was booked for this gig because other people kept dropping out of it. So originally J.J. Abrams was supposed to adapt the Dark Tower series after Lost, and that never happened. Then they got Ron Howard in. He was going to get the project off the ground. That didn't happen either. If they make any more, I will eat my hat, because I do not see how this is going to turn into a successful series. This has bombed.
No.
By all accounts, this has bombed critically, at the box office. It's not a success by any kind of measure, which in a way is a shame. It would be nice to see a good epic fantasy series after, you know, we've had Lord of the Rings and Hobbit, and Game of Thrones is now in its penultimate series. I mean, it still would be nice to see that, but I don't think it's going to be the Dark Tower series.
No.
This week sees a return of our triple bill feature, where, as The Dark Tower has been released, which is, of course, a Stephen King adaptation, we pick our favourite three Stephen King adaptations, either TV shows or films, whichever we prefer, or a combination of which.
Yeah, we kind of left it quite broad, I think. It just could be your favourite three Stephen King big screen things, or,
maybe even you could have picked the Simpsons Treehouse of Horror where they did The Shining.
Maybe not that broad.
I don't reckon anyone did, but I probably would have let you.
Yeah. Okay. No, you could have had something like Creepshow, though, for example, which isn't an adaptation of anything he wrote, but it's his screenplay, which was an anthology horror film directed by George Romero, for example. But you could also have had any number of his big screen... I mean, as we mentioned at the beginning, Green Mile, his most... highest grossing film. Anything in between.
I suppose he is, of course, most known for his kind of horrors, but he is quite versatile, really, isn't he, in terms of his writing? When you look at the films that he's had, the adaptations made, with things like The Green Mile and Stand By Me and different things like that, Shawshank Redemption. It's not just horrors that he does. He has got some versatility to him.
Yeah,
although I mean, horror is his strong point.
There are some like famous tropes of, well, not necessarily tropes, but the things that people associate with all of his work anyway. I mean, one of the sort of cliches or stereotypes of his work is that he can't write an ending. You think that's one of the things that gets thrown at him is that everything is great up until the last 30 pages, where things tend to go a bit tits up. Although, like his stuff is about, you know, the loss of innocence in young people, like kids who are forced to grow up quickly due to some traumatic event. That's a common motif.
But that draws from his own personal life, I think.
Yeah, similarly, it's about alcoholics or people who are addicted to stuff because he was or is an alcoholic. Stories that deal with grief because the death of his mom kind of impacted him quite heavily. Lots of stuff about small town Americana. All of that kind of stuff is present in almost all of his work, regardless of the genre that it kind of fits into.
Yeah, but write about what you know.
It's working for him. I read he writes 2,000 words a day. Well, he used to write 2,000 words a day up until his car hit and run accident. No, it was, I don't know if it was a hit and run, but his car accident where he was run off the road. As a pedestrian as well, broke his hip, smashed a few other bones. It's quite a traumatic thing, and that's probably why a lot of his work has stuff about scary cars in it. Because, yeah, like I say, write about what you know. If you're sitting in a room for like hours and hours a day writing 2,000 words, eventually the stuff that you are scared of will creep into your traumas and stuff.
Anyway, Owen, what is your first pick? What is your first choice in this triple bill?
Okay. It is probably incredibly obvious, but let's get it out of the way, first of all. The Shining from 1980, which is the Stanley Kubrick adaptation of his
novel. That was one of mine as well.
Is that one of yours?
Yeah, mate.
Yeah.
And Liam, Maya, did you pick The Shining?
No, it's on my backup list, but no, I didn't.
The only one, which I'm sure I was probably going to go on to say that Stephen King didn't actually like that adaptation.
No, I think he softened over time, but no, he hated it. He hated it so much he created his own version. He adapted it himself as a TV movie.
And it was where Kubrick was trying to tell us that he filmed the moon landing.
That was the secret message of the Shining.
Yeah.
All that money spent by the studio so he could say, I filmed the moon landing.
No, yes, Kubrick filmed the moon landings.
That's what they want you to think. Of course not. No. So I think I've explained this, or I've told this story before as well about The Shining. The first time I watched The Shining was when I was about 15, I think, probably 14. I was in secondary school, and I'd spent ages downloading it on a 56K modem. It took forever. And when I watched it, I laughed all the way through it. I thought it was completely naff and not at all scary. I thought it was hilarious with the naked old biddy in the bathtub and all that kind of stuff. Then, of course, I grew up and watched it again and have come to the sensible and correct conclusion that it's possibly one of the best films of all time. And certainly one of the best horrors. And easily, for me, the best adaptation of a Stephen King novel. Even if King himself wasn't particularly pleased with it at the time. I did have a look to see if Stephen King has ever said what his favourite films are based on his work. Unsurprisingly, The Shining doesn't list among them.
No, I think he took umbrage to Jack Nicholson being cast in it, didn't he?
He didn't like Jack Nicholson.
Don't blame him there.
Yeah.
Don't blame him there. Nicholson's crap.
I love Jack Nicholson.
I like him.
Yeah. He's Jack Torrance, the aspiring writer who accepts a caretaker job at a remote, isolated hotel in the winter. That's kind of the story, isn't it? Yeah, him and his wife, Wendy,
yeah,
and their son, Danny, who's got The Shining, or The Shine,
yes,
which is also something that features in The Dark Tower, The Shine.
Yes.
And, and then obviously unexplainable ghostly goings-on. So Stephen King said his favourite adaptations of his work. Do you want me to read them now, or should we do it at the end, actually?
Do it at the end.
Okay, we'll see if any of those.
We can all see if we're thinking like Mr. King.
Yeah, but The Shining though is just fantastic, isn't it? I mean, obviously.
Yeah.
Liam, Steve, you must agree more so than Maya. But what do you?
No,
what...
I love it. I do like it.
Oh, excellent. So we're all in agreement then, because it is a little bit divisive. Yeah. I know there are some people who, as well as Stephen King, really dislike The Shining. But
I think it's an absolutely great movie. I still think, actually, I watched it night before last.
Oh yeah.
Just as a mind jogger and just to make sure I wasn't remembering wrong. And to be honest, at first I thought, I've boobed here. I should have picked something else. This isn't as good as I remember. But it is. It's just, it's Nicholson. I really don't like Jack Nicholson as an actor. He's, to me, he's a Richard Burton. He's so busy being Jack Nicholson playing, it's a Jack Nicholson in a Jack Nicholson production of.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. He's so busy pulling his faces and looking under his eyes at things. And to be honest, Shelley Duvall, it just really struck me this time. I don't know if it was why it struck me more this time, just how much she looks like the character in the painting of the screen. She really does.
I don't think that's a compliment.
Well, I mean, she's not exactly having the best day in her life, is she? That's true. They can allow her to look at. I will say, and the way she sort of runs about with her arms flailing does put you in mind of, when Monty Burns goes a bit weird in Simpsons, and it's in the, when he's running about the woods all glowing.
Yeah.
She does remind you of that.
I guess so.
I'm slagging it off here, but it's a fantastic film. Yeah. Despite the people that are in it, the kid is brilliant. I will give him that.
Mm.
The little boy is brilliant.
So creepy.
And I can't think of many more modern films that have had so many influences in so many other different things,
Mm-hmm.
It's referenced constantly in loads of stuff, isn't it? Even like Family Guy with Stewie with his playing blocks, at one point say Red Rum.
Yeah, and his tricycle thing that he rides around on.
And his tricycle, he's always on his trike. Yeah, they do that one as well, don't they? And he comes up against the little girls and that.
I mean, there's so many things that have parodied The Shining, isn't there?
Yeah.
But that's just the sign of something that's really got a bit of staying power, isn't it? It was 1980 released. Still now, contemporary pop culture parodies exist of it because it's just so impactful.
Yeah.
I found it terrifying the first time I watched it.
Oh, right.
Absolutely terrifying. And the kid and everything, just the build up of the tension.
Don't fully trust twins. Still something not quite right about them. Anyway, so mine and Liam's first choice has also been taken. So Maya, you're up.
Okay, I've gone with and it's not in any particular order in terms of what I like and what I don't like. So I've gone with something I watched recently, which was Misery.
That's one of mine as
Oh,
well.
Oh, sorry.
I'm just not going to do any talking.
No, you can do it.
Misery's one that I only saw recently as well on Sky Go. But, yeah, I thought it was great.
Yeah, I thought I'd seen it before. And I'd always said to people, I have seen it. I know what it is. I knew the concept, and it wasn't until I sat down to watch it that I was like, I have actually seen this before. So probably a week or so ago, I watched it, and I was glued. Normally, I am falling asleep if I'm watching a film in the evening after running around after the tiny person. But this time I was like glued to it, and it was creepy. And Kathy Bates was amazing, as is always. When people talk about Misery, that's one of the biggest things they say about the film is her. And she won an Oscar for that as well, didn't she?
Yeah. When I reviewed it the first time, or when I was talking about it, I called her Kathy Burke, and that's a completely different film.
Yeah, that would be completely different.
Yeah.
But no, she is amazing in it. Just really, like, intense, and
the way she switches.
Yeah.
It's quite...
She goes from placid to mental in the blink of an eye.
Yeah.
But like you said, when you said you thought you'd seen it before, I kind of did, but just for the amount of times it's been, like, The Shining parody.
Yes.
It's kind of, you already know the story because it's been parodied so much. like in The Simpsons and Family Guy and all stuff like that. But by the time you see it, you actually know the plot, really, or yeah. know kind of an idea of what's going to happen. But then you watch the film and the performances are just unreal.
Yeah, the I can't remember what she called it, but the ankle bit.
Mm.
Yeah.
I can't remember what she called it now because of the H, I'm sure of it. Hobbling or something like that.
Yeah.
That was just, you know, hands over my face, watching it through a tiny gap in my fingers and just kind of holding on to my feet as I'm doing that because it was just intense. And just the little bits in there that were quite shocking and quite, it's not a horror, but it really did feel quite tense, like a horror does. In some parts, because it is quite a, you know, really good thriller, and I really enjoyed it. So I thought I'd go for 1990 Misery.
So we're already back to round to Owen with his second choice.
I went for Pet Sematary, 1989, directed by Mary Lambert.
I thought you'd go for Pet Sematary.
Yes. Yeah, of course. I mean, how many others on this podcast have seen it? I know, Maya, you've seen everything up to the end, right? You didn't go back and watch the finale.
No. I haven't brought myself back to watch the whole film yet. I still can't. Cats and kids in horror movies freak the shit out of me, so.
And it has both of them in that, yeah.
Exactly. And I haven't been able to finish watching that film yet.
I mean, I saw it ages ago. I saw it once a long, long time ago, and it's... Mm-hmm. I'm aware that I used to watch a lot of horror at that time, and it was a good one.
Yeah.
I thought it was a very good film, but I couldn't tell you a damn thing about it now.
Fair enough, yeah. I mean, the famous line from it is that sometimes dead is better, right? Sometimes movies about animals and kids, Maya, where they die and come back to life, are better as horror films. Yeah. I think it's the only movie in my triple bill as well, I should say, that I read the book before watching the film. But even so, even knowing the book before the movie, I love the adaptation of Pet Sematary because it is just like a glorious B-movie popcorn thriller. I mean, for those that don't know the story of it, I mean, it's fairly simple. There's a pet cemetery, which is spelt S-E-M-A-T-A-R-Y, because the pet cemetery in the small American town, which is down the beaten path behind the house of Dr. Lewis Creed, his new family home that he's recently moved into. The sign was written by kids, which is kids who were evidently not taught how to spell. Oh, I guess they weren't. You know, if they were grieving about their recently deceased family pet, there wasn't an adult around to say, no, you've spelt that incorrectly. Start again. Paint another sign. But anyway, like the cemetery is built next to a cursed Indian burial ground. Very politically incorrect, which can bring the dead back to life because of some evil Wendigo spirit thing that is there. And so the family's cat dies, and the lovable neighbour, Judd, the one who says the sometimes dead is better line, he helps Lewis bring the cat back to life. And then Lewis' son dies. He's hit by a truck. And, he just plans to use the burial ground to bring his kid back to life as well. And then it all goes a bit horrific. I do really like the book. I think there's a great audiobook adaptation out there as well of this. Which used to be on YouTube. I don't know if it's still there. If you find it somewhere, it's well worth checking out. It's just like a dramatisation. But for like a 90-ish minute monster movie, I think this is a really good Stephen King adaptation. I'm aware there are more dramatic King movies. There are other movies that deal with more heavy subject matter and probably even similar subject matter to this and do it probably better or with more nuance, but I just think this is great. I think everything from Fred Gwynne as Judd to the way it's shot, to the atmosphere of it, even to the script. I think the script is pretty strong for what is effectively a B-movie. I'd really recommend people check it out if they have perhaps scoffed at it in the past or, yeah, for whatever reason decided not to give it a go. It also has a very disgustingly disturbing scene towards the end.
Yes.
So that is another. That is what would be a
recommendation. I stopped it.
Yeah, that would be a recommendation for me if someone said that about it. I'd go, ooh, I'll make a note of that one. So yeah, Pet Sematary is my second choice.
Okay. Liam, what's your second choice?
My second choice, again, I'm going to couch it in the same way as The Shining. In it's very good, despite the actor. The Dead Zone.
Okay.
The Dead Zone with Christopher Walken. This is what I thought I'd try and do was I'd have my best horror one, my best sort of anthology one, and then my best. I know it's not like Tales of the Unexpected or Tales of the Mildly Fucked Up or something like that. You know? But The Dead Zone is basically a school teacher. He's involved in a car accident. When he comes around, he gets put into a coma. He comes around 5 years later. And now, again, another one that's been parodied in loads of stuff. Mm-hmm. Anyone whose hand he holds, he can suddenly see into their future. Usually often around their deaths, but... you can see into the future, and it's basically another story that looks into the idea that if you'd known in advance what Hitler was going to do, mm-hmm. would you stop him? Would you kill him? It's like a moral dilemma like that. It's not a horror in any way. I suppose mildly a thriller type thing. It's more a thriller type thing. This is one I rewatched to make sure I remembered it as being good. Remembered it as good as it sort of stuck in my mind. But yeah, I did thoroughly enjoy it again. Despite Christopher Walken, I always think, I mean, he is a bloke blessed with the perfect looks to be in a horror or certainly mm-hmm. a psychological thriller type thing. But the only time I've ever seen him act any good was in that Fat Boy Slim video a few years back. That's the only time I've actually ever enjoyed a performance of it.
Oh, I really like again, him in that. He has a little bit in Pulp Fiction, doesn't he? Where he talks about the pocket watch. It's always.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's yeah, good. Sorry, I forgot about that little. Yeah, yes, I'll take it back. Yeah, that bit was quite good. Yeah, he was good in that. But, like I say, other than that, the Fat Boy Slim video is about the only thing I'm taking in. But this film is a real belt. It's back from. 1983, so a long old time ago. Yeah, it's got plenty of problems about it if you want to pick holes in it. Like, how the hell as he comes out of his coma, his mum and dad are there, and he hasn't noticed that they're, like, I mean, when you get old, 5 years makes a hell of a difference to your opinion, mm-hmm. to your appearance, rather, sorry. Makes a hell of a difference to your appearance, and... He doesn't realise he's been asleep for 5 years when he looks at his mum and then just starts talking to him normally, mm-hmm. sort of thing, you know, and you think, well, you'd know. And it has several, it's got several time-lapse problems in all of its stories, but I think the overall overarching thing of the, if you could stop Hitler, would you, mm-hmm. type thing, it's been done before, it's been done a lot, but this was a good version of it, a film I really enjoyed.
Yeah, it's good. It's good performance from Martin Sheen in it as well. Plays a real bastard, doesn't
yes,
he?
Yes, yeah, very much so. Yeah. Oh yeah, he does do bastard very well. Mm. Yeah, and he is very very good in it. I will give you that. Yeah, it's just a good story. Well done. To be honest.
When I watched it, I was expecting, because it's directed by David Cronenberg, for it to be very. Basically, body horror, I
more
suppose.
More horror-y. Yeah,
exactly. Gory, yeah, a bit twisted. And I don't think it was that, but it was definitely morally vague, wasn't it? There was no committal to what is the right thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, it left it up to you whether you decided he was right or wrong to do what he did, try doing what he did. The reasons that he did it, was it just purely in the public good, future mm-hmm. public good? Was it... I mean, he got this girl. The girl he was due to marry before his accident. She comes back in the story as a sort of second or third in command to Martin Sheen. So they were certainly involved in the hierarchy of it and that. Where's his moral compass coming from? He's involved in it as well. It's a very good film. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't want to oversell it, but it's. It's certainly a very pleasant way to spend an hour and a half, you know?
Okay. Maya, what's your second pick?
My second one is quite a new one, Cell. It's
okay.
Well, it's I think it's on Sky Premier at the moment. So I watched it there. Stephen King's novel, and it was from last year, with John Cusack and Samuel Jackson. And it's interesting. It's the best way I can try and describe it is it's like Walking Dead, but with mobile phones. The movie starts off with John Cusack talking to his wife and kid on the phone at the airport. And he puts his phone away, and there's obviously, as is nowadays, so many people around him on their mobile phones, listening to music, on their iPads, etc., etc. And something happens, and there's a kind of a frequency noise, and then they all start turning and beating each other, killing each other, very, very violently, I thought, in some cases, you know, bashing their own heads against the wall. And it's very zombie style, but all to do with these mobile phones. He then happens to meet Samuel Jackson along the way. There's obviously a journey where he's trying to get somewhere. He's trying to get back to his family to see if they're okay. Meets a few people along the way.
Does Samuel L. Jackson say motherfucker?
Do you know what? I actually waited to hear. I was looking for that. No, he doesn't. he actually.
I thought that was in his contract.
I was a little upset actually that he didn't say it, but because I was listening for it, it's all right. There were moments. I like the concept. It's quite interesting. Because it's very modernised about the whole idea of being controlled via frequencies from your cell phone and those kind of ideas. And there were moments, you know, the ending was quite interesting, but there were some really boring bits in there. And, you know, Samuel Jackson didn't say motherfucker. And I think if he did, I may have enjoyed it a little bit more. John Cusack was all right in it, you know. I think them two have worked together on they were both in 1408 actually, from my recollection, which was another Stephen King adaptation. Yeah, it was all right. It wasn't scary. There were some few gory bits in there. It was an interesting concept that just wasn't really executed that well, but 2016's, or 17 actually for us, Cell.
Okay, we're back round to Owen again for some final picks. So, Owen, what is your last choice?
My last choice is the first Stephen King novel, Carrie, which was adapted in 1976 by Brian De Palma. And any crossover on that one?
No.
Okay, just me on that one then. So Carrie is played by Sissy Spacek, and one of the things I found out for the first time watching or reading up about Carrie earlier was that it's John Travolta's first film role too. Did not know that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No. Who is he playing?
He was one of her sort of school chums. It's a boy who has a car, which does not go well for him. Carrie is the story of a telekinetic or a teenage girl with telekinetic powers, which is, instead of like telepathy, telekinesis is when you move stuff, right? So she's quite a powerful, or she's learning to that she has these powers where she can move things and control things with her mind. But she is viciously bullied by her fellow students at school, and has a very paranoid, religious, kind of verging on psychopathic mother who locks Carrie in a cupboard under the stairs with a Bible to pray for her sins. And the sins range from basically anything that a young girl would do for fun is a sin. Put it that way. Also, really, the film is about puberty and like becoming an adult or becoming a woman, particularly becoming a woman with a great big dollop of blood at the end of it, just to kind of make sure you get the message, right? You get it. As well as the, it's got an infamous plug it up scene, right? I know that was a bit grim, but like, yeah, there's a scene where she has her first period and she doesn't know what's happening to her, and she's in the showers at school because her mom is this religious zealot who doesn't talk about that kind of thing because it's dirty, and so she is having this thing happen to her in the shower. She panics, and all the kids are just teasing her, saying, plug it up, plug it up, plug it up, and stuff like that. And, you know, it's a very powerful scene within the film, particularly with regards to the theme that it's trying to address. But I can't help but feel it's a bit weird, because it's a school scene, it's in a shower, and all of the girls kind of have their dirty pillows on show, as the mother of Carrie calls them, if you know what I'm getting at. It's a school show scene. That's not necessary, Mr. De Palma. We didn't need that. But anyway, so it felt kind of typically King throughout as well, I would say. It's got quite a few disturbing moments in it, quite gory, graphic scenes. I wouldn't say it's a terrifying film, though. I think it's just one of these, like I said at the very start, Stephen King's films, they deal with themes of youth being taken away, almost necessarily being shed. And I think that's the main theme that runs through Carrie. And it was interesting, that's his first novel, that lots of stuff that happens in this, you can spot in absolutely all of his other work as well. There are lots of motifs that are brought into this that are there through everything else. But yeah. So yeah, Carrie from 1976. I will say, though, that Carrie remake that we also mentioned earlier on in the quiz, the remake by Kimberly Pierce that has Chloe Grace Moretz and Julianne Moore in it, is also decent. It is actually a fairly good remake. What isn't a good remake or sequel to Carrie? There were a few films dotted around. I think there was one that came out around 2002, 2001, which is not great. You don't need to see that. But the original is just best. That film is just fantastic for a whole host of reasons. So yeah, Carrie, my final choice.
Liam, your final choice, please.
My final one is, I went for like one of the sort of short story anthology type things. But rather than go for creep shows, I went for one that I don't think is overly popular, but I really enjoy, is Cat's Eye.
Okay.
When I said to my brother a couple of months back about who was going to do this triple bill, he said, "Oh, what about Cat's Eye? I remember that being good." And I thought, yeah, I could only remember one bit, but I've had a rewatch and it's really a very good one. Three stories all linked together. The only thing that links the three of them is this cat that sort of wanders in and out of the first two stories and then is a big part of the third. First story is about a man who goes to a service to help you stop smoking. It's James Woods in there, and they use extreme measures to help you pack up the fags, which I did last year. And found incredibly old, so I'll go with that. And then I found it dead easy after a very short while, which will probably annoy no end of people trying to do it. Anyway, the idea is they won't do anything to you, but they are always watching. And the minute you light up, they'll do something to your family. The wife is put into a room with an electrified floor. And then later you show like bits of fingers being chopped off, have been chopped off if you stray from the straight and narrow line sort of thing. Really, it's been done a couple of times. I think it's one of his, because you, like was said before about his fascination with addiction, with alcohol, being an alcoholic. This is about giving up the fags, and it's a good story. It's bits of it are very well done. Notable for a really good song. I like that. 96 Tears by the Mysterians, that plays when they electrify the floor. So, you know, even if you get electrified, at least you've got a tune to go with it, you know? And then the second story is the one that's stuck in my mind the most, the one I could remember the most about. It's the fella whose name escapes me now, the bloke from Airplane with the drinking problem.
Oh,
you know,
Oh,
what's his name? Is it Robert Hayes?
Yes, Robert Hayes, yeah.
Robert Hayes. So, yeah, him. He's in it as a gambler who's carrying on with he's having an affair with the wife of a real sort of high stakes, high roller gambler, and he gets found out, and this man, basically, he gets a choice. They'll either plant, he's got the sheriff in his pocket, this fellow, and they will either plant a load of cocaine in this bloke's car and he'll do umpteen years in prison, or he can take the gamble, which is to walk around the ledge of the top of a hotel, a very high hotel. And it's reasonably windy, and the bit that always stuck in my mind with this, the image I had that was the bit that stuck, reminded me, oh yeah, we'll rewatch it, was a pigeon constantly pecking at his ankles as he's trying to go around the corner of these buildings. That's the second short story. And then the third one, where the cat actually takes part in it, is of a little girl, Drew Barrymore, in one of her first, I think it's about a fourth or fifth film. She's in it as a very young girl with a troll, living a weird little troll living in her skirting board. And the cat comes to save her. That's kind of the shtick, is right at the very start, she appears as a mannequin in a shop window that the cat is looking in. And she starts going on about, you have to help me. And it's a loose thing that runs throughout like that. One thing I will say, that one of the bits I did enjoy most about this is it's got lots of little humorous nods, especially in the interlude between things, is that the very first scenes of the film are the cat running away from a St. Bernard dog that's got blood all over it. And so it's referencing Cujo there. Runs past a car, that nearly gets run over by a car that's got a Christine sticker on its bumper. And there's no numerous references to other Stephen King works in it. Actually, Pet Sematary is referenced in it with the story with the troll, the mother of the Drew Barrymore's mum in it, is laying in bed on the night where this troll really attacks and it all kicks off. She's laying in bed reading the book, and you just see, as she goes to put it down, the back of the book, it's Pet Sematary that she's reading. So there's lots of little half sort of humorous nods there. I just found it a better watch and an easier going. It's got humorous highlights in it, so it's a bit different to other bits of Creepshow, which, to be honest, I think I watched so often that I kind of bored myself off, you know? When back ages ago, sort of thing, when I was watching loads of that sort of thing, mid-teens sort of era, I watched loads of that sort of thing. I think I kind of bored myself at that. So that's why Cat's Eyes was a good choice for me. I like that one, even though it seems to be rather unpopular if you look online about it.
Yeah, I hadn't even heard of it. I'd never heard of it before. So,
yeah. You know, 1985. Oh, IMDb give it 6.3 and gets moaned at about, you know, different things. But no, it's a three reasonably entertaining. It's certainly lightweight. There's suspense to a couple of it, more suspense than anything, but it's all got light, humorous touches, and it's a nice film to watch.
Okay. Maya, your final choice, please.
Okay. My final choice is probably quite an obvious one, actually. 1994, Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah, that's the same as me.
I thought we were going to get through the whole thing then without mentioning Shawshank. I was getting a bit nervous.
No. No, it needs to be mentioned, doesn't it? And that's why I left it till last.
I mean, I considered leaving it out because it's too obvious, but I thought, well, I can't really, because it's bloody brilliant.
Yeah. And I think that's what, that's why I thought I did it in that a very obscure order, just so I could leave Shawshank to the end.
Yeah.
I'm absolutely amazing. I would love to read the novel. I actually haven't. And it's something that is on my list of books that I do want to read eventually. But I absolutely love the film. Can watch it over and over again. I don't know what else to say other than it is absolutely fantastic.
Is it possibly the start of Morgan Freeman's career as a narrator?
I can imagine so, yeah.
Was it the first film that he done a narration?
I don't know, actually. But if it was, he did a very good job, and yeah, I can see why.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
There was a spell where it was on like ITV. You know how ITV2 have filmed in rotation?
Yeah.
There was like a period where it was on like every week and probably watched some of it at least once a fortnight, if not all of it.
It is one of those films that you could just go to and go, oh yeah, I'll watch that. And then you just realise how much you enjoy it again and again and again. And I think every time I watch it, I notice something different about it or something new or, you know, something that I never caught before. But yeah, it's so powerful and it's such a good story. Such a good story.
Yeah, I just love the scene where Andy Dufresne gets some old beers on the roof.
Yeah, that is brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah, the mixture of flashbacks and just the way that the characters develop a bond and then, you know, it's all about being able to survive on the outside as well as there where they actually are. And
it's quite clever as well, the way the plot progresses and unfolds.
I think it's one of the least Stephen Kingy of what you would automatically sort of assume in your head as still. I know he's quite a varied writer, as we've said before, but I was surprised I think I must have come into it halfway through when I very, very first saw it, like donkeys years ago, sort of thing. And it was until like the end when they said based upon Stephen King, sort of thing. I really, I would never have put that down. It's a fantastic film, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great all round, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's one of those ones that you just you don't have to say much more than if you haven't seen it, go watch it.
Yeah,
and you will love it. Yeah. And if you don't, you're an idiot.
Or Owen, as you said, I thought we were going to go through this whole thing without it being mentioned. Do you not like it?
I do like it. I'm always baffled when I'm reminded that it's the best film ever, 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 according to IMDb ratings. And I think it's not really, though, is it? It's not. It's good. And I don't.
Yeah, it's good, yeah.
It even makes me forget that I hate narration, because I hate narration in movies. It really is one of those bugbears of mine, and particularly
even with Morgan Freeman's dulcet tones.
Particularly Morgan Freeman's dulcet tones. What's that Clint Eastwood film where there's the woman boxer? Million Dollar Baby. In that, the narration is completely pointless of Morgan Freeman. Just literally just says what you see on the screen. It doesn't add anything. Just stop it. It's irritating.
Do you remember when he just ended up doing narration for a bit? Like on the Tom Cruise War of the Worlds film, he just done narration at the beginning and the end.
That was him, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Just
talking about aliens getting the flu and that.
Yeah. It became a joke and a cliche because it was just done all the time for no reason and didn't ever add anything. But I think, even I can't deny, really, it was good in Shawshank. I think he's great in it. Shall I tell you something as well? So I mentioned earlier about Stephen King and his three favourite adaptations of his work. The Shawshank Redemption is one of the three.
Yeah.
The other two we haven't mentioned yet. Do you want to have a guess what you think they might be?
I was surprised nobody mentioned Children of the Corn.
Were you? No.
I thought, because I don't like it, but I don't like it, but it seems incredibly popular all the time.
It's dog shit. It's a terrible film.
Was Stand By Me one of his favourites?
Stand By Me was one of his favourite three adaptations.
See, now I thought about Stand By Me for my list,
yeah.
Thinking, you know, it's a nice coming-of-age film, and it reminds me of growing up with friends, but I thought, well, me and my friends never went and looked for and found a dead body, so you can't really draw many comparisons with it.
No. Did you ever have friends...
End.
Like yeah. Friends you made when you were 12.
Did I ever have friends? Yes, I would have friends.
Yeah, that seems a bit far fetched. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's so far Shawshank Redemption and Stand By Me. His other one, I don't know whether you'll guess straight away, but his other third favourite. His other favourite, I should say.
I'm going to have a guess at one. The one I'm reading, Needful Things.
No. That would be an obscure guess. But no.
I've not seen the film. I've heard it's rubbish.
It's not that obscure.
The Langoliers.
The what? Langoliers?
Is that how it's said? I don't know.
I don't know what that is.
No.
Not that one. Anyway, no.
No.
I'll give you a clue. It's another Frank Darabont film. Same director as Shawshank.
The Mist?
The Mist? Yep. He said his...
I mean, the ending's great.
I really like The Mist. I think it's a really good sci-fi monster movie. But yeah, the ending is fantastic. The ending is also not the ending from the book. Another one, actually, where I read the novel before, or the short story before watching the film. And then that ending to the film was like, what the fuck is this? This is dark. This was not what I was expecting at all. But yeah, so his three favourite adaptations of his own novels are Stand By Me, Shawshank Redemption and The Mist, two of which didn't feature in any of our triple bills. It is an interesting combo, yeah.
But the Mist ending, the film version is great.
Mm. Yeah.
It's just horrible, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Funny, really darkly funny, because it's not real. It's fake. It's a movie,
yeah.
So you can laugh at it, but yeah, pretty grim.
But yeah, that's all for the triple bill. Some great suggestions in there. But to finish off the podcast, some recommendations. I'm going to go with the one I spoke about in what we've been watching, What Happened to Monday on Netflix. Owen?
Well, I've kind of got two recommendations, really. They're on TV. So Friday night on Film 4. It's basically, I couldn't not mention this. Friday night, Film 4, from 9 p.m. There's a double bill of Predator and then Predator 2. Obviously, Predator 2 is on after Predator. But the one that I thought would be that I should probably mention, because it's Bank Holiday Monday, people sometimes like to just treat it like a Sunday. Just watch an afternoon TV film on Channel 5.
Weekend at Bernie's.
It's not Weekend at Bernie's. No.
No.
It's at 2:35 p.m. on Channel 5. The Searchers, the John Wayne, John Ford classic.
Yeah.
Which is also on after Rio Lobo, but I thought you don't have to watch Rio Lobo if you don't want to, but you do have to watch The Searchers. It's mandatory.
So technically, that's three recommendations. But
yeah, fine. Three then.
Yeah. Maya?
I've kind of gone for two, only because they're on at the same time, so you've got a choice. Friday, 9 p.m. I did have Predator on there, actually. But on Dave is Centurion, and on Watch is Demolition Man, Friday, 9 p.m.
Okay, and Liam?
Well, like you, the one I went on what we've been watching, so Lady Macbeth on Curzon, or if you want one on telly, next Tuesday night, I think it is, on Film 4, they've got the Hungarian film White God, which is about dog uprising.
Oh, yeah.
Not as weird as it sounds, but it's very good.
I thought there was a split second... Like, the tiniest part of my brain then, that when you were starting to say that, I thought you were going to say The Hunger Games. I was like, that's not very Liam-like.
No, 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 no. Now, you know, I have completely gone mental if I start with
exactly, yeah. When it ended with Hungarian, yeah. I was like, oh, there we go. That's the one. Yeah, that's Liam.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. Hungarian, yeah. Hungary's brilliant. You should always look up Hungary for a film. They make some great films out there.
Well, that is all for this week's Failed Critics podcast, then. Thank you to Liam and Maya for joining me and Owen, and thank you all for listening. Owen, what are we doing next week, other than Don't Say a Podcast?
We're doing a podcast, yeah. It's basically you and I have to take a back seat almost next week because we've got Andrew Brooker, he's back on the podcast, and so is Mike Shawcross for the first time in what must be like 18 months, 24 months, because of Fright Fest is taking place from the 24th to the 28th, both Andrew and Mike are attending Fright Fest, and they're going to join us and basically tell us what was great about Fright Fest, what films we should look out for, all of that kind of thing. So I'm really looking forward to that. I always like hearing about Fright Fest.
Well, yes, I said thank you for joining us, and join us for the Fright Fest special next week.
The Failed Critics podcast is presented by Steve Norman and Owen Hughes, with contributions from different guests every week, with original music provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com from the track The Bandit, remixed by James Yule, who you can find at jamesyule.com. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Failed Critics, on iTunes and all good podcast apps, or you can check us out at failedcritics.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and leave a rating or a review. And why not check out our sister podcasts, Character Unlock and Bill De Mullinger's Underground Nights, from the Failed Media Network of podcasts. Thanks for listening.
This week sees a return of our triple bill feature, and with The Dark Tower being a Stephen King adaptation, we're going to take a look at our favourite three Stephen King adaptations, whether that's a film or a TV show, entirely up to ourselves. Owen, you did ask our fans on Twitter for theirs. Did we get any responses?
Kurt, let's not mention the fact that only one person replied, and that is the husband of one of the people present on this podcast.
Okay.
he said he was a bit of an idiot with it.
I saw the tweet just before I left work for football, and then haven't looked since.
I don't think it was entirely serious.
No, it wasn't.
Okay.
No, he said Sleepwalkers, Thinner, and Dreamcatcher. I kind of resent Thinner being in there because I think Thinner's fine. I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with Thinner. But I mean, if you want to go all Guardian, it's quite problematic because a gypsy puts a curse on a fat man that keeps making him thinner. But you know.
Okay. Well, I'll start again. Okay.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.